The Business on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Ulster Bank. For when you want business experts that get to know you, not just your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/businessmatters.
Well, as the European Union tries to deal with the departure of one of its largest members, there are some who are looking to the past for answers. The precursors of the EU were formed in the aftermath of World War II to unite countries economically and politically in order to secure lasting peace in the region. This week, we travelled to the Irish Military War Museum in County Meath, owned by William Sullivan. It includes military memorabilia from the First World War right through to the Gulf War.
So what we're doing here is we're walking through the World War I section. So it just gives you an idea, the sounds and what World War I trenches would have looked like.
It's like we've just walked into the Battle of the Somme here. We're in what looks like a trench, and it looks fairly cramped in there.
Well, that would have been made there for 3 officers. So that was actually luxurious at the time. So it just gives you an idea what the living conditions were like. And they had the best of the best, where the poor old guys on the ground now were really slogging in the muck. As we're walking through the trench, you can actually see the debris from World War One, all the bits and pieces that myself and 3 other friends found over 12 hours walking across the fields of France. So hand grenades, rifles, shells.
These are all just lying around the battlefields over there.
To this day, if you walk over the fields of France, you'll find shrapnel still lying on the fields. It's called the Iron Harvest, because what happens is the farmers go over every year, they plough every year, and new stuff comes up. So new unexploded shells. Last year, 3 farmers were killed, 2 men working on the road were killed, 2 bomb disposal experts were killed, and 2 guys laying a gas line were actually killed as well last year.
Wow. So. What's this? This is a big, very old machine gun on a stand here. What's that, William?
That's a German MG08 machine gun. It's a water-cooled gun, fired approximately 500 bullets a minute. What you'll see here in the museum is the evolution from World War I to 500 rounds to World War II, 1,500 rounds a minute.
When did you start gathering up all of it? Was it when you were a kid that you started to collect this stuff?
Yeah, I started at the age of 8. I found a coin belonging to my granddad, and he was a marksman in the Royal Irish Fusiliers, and he went through World War One from 1914 to 1919. And then John Wayne didn't help on a Saturday at the television either, like, you know. So yeah, it kind of got sucked in.
So you started with the coin, and then you moved on to the AK-47s, wasn't it?
It's a bit like that. Okay, I'd go off and I'd pick a ton of potatoes on the local farm, and you got 20 punt for picking a ton of potatoes. That meant I could buy a gas mask, or I'd clean out calf sheds, clean out manure. You were doing any and every job to make a few pounds, and all the time buying bits and pieces with it. And that's how it came about, really.
Do you know how much you've spent over the years building up this collection, or what it's worth today?
450,000 I spent. That's from the age of 8 to today. Probably valued about 2.5 million. So that's the way you look at it. Military stuff, World War One, World War Two, and the magic numbers are 1914 to 1918 and 1939 to 1945. They're the magic numbers. So anything inside that are crazy money. Their prices are going up and up and up.
William, I see you have what would have been, it's like just a small soldier shovel there, World War One.
Yes, this is actually a German entrenching tool. It's a shovel. Very, very simple, very, very straightforward, probably about a 2 foot long, flat head on it. But the Germans used to actually sharpen the edge of it. So the idea of that was, not only was it a shovel, it was now a fighting tool. So if you hit a man on the shoulder, you're going to break his shoulder blade. If you hit him on the neck, you're going to break his neck or decapitate his head. Underneath the chin, you're hitting the throat, decapitating the head or crushing the Adam's apple. The temple, top of the head pops clear off. When you're finished with it, I get a lovely warm fuzzy feeling at this stage of the museum, I'll be honest with you. When you're finished with it, you clean it down, you can dig a hole with it, or you can put your rashers and sausages on it and cook your dinner. It's a multi-tool machine, and that's the reality of it. And it's so simple, but yet these are still being used today by actually the Russian army.
So it'll keep you alive in more ways than one, and even bury you when you're dead.
Yeah. There you are. It'll dig you into a hole and dig you out of one.
Are you in a difficult area sometimes with kids? Because for me, and for, I'm sure for yourself, when I was a boy growing up, the idea of actually seeing a real gun would have been a big thrill. But at the same time, is it a celebration of warfare and people killing each other, or is it a way of educating people about the reality of what's involved in that?
Well, you can see it on the kids when they walk in the door. They kind of go, wow, it's fantastic. But then the reality of, like, you're after walking by a display there with a skeleton in it. So in World War One, about 8 days, if you were lying dead in no man's land for 8 days, you turned from a man to a skeleton because the rats, the maggots, the flies. My granddad, the only thing he ever said about World War One was, he says, you'll get used to sleeping on top of dead bodies, but I'll never get used to the rats. And that's the reality of it. You know, so there's nothing glorious or glamorous about war. You're just after walking by the Russian section, the Canadian section. So, and this is the new extension here. We added 9,000 square feet onto the museum last year. So you just get an idea of...
You've got jeeps, trucks, vehicles, tanks. William, it's like we've walked straight into the middle of World War II here.
Well, you're actually looking at Ireland's only convoy of American World War II vehicles. So, like, you'd be laughing at me. The Jeep, like J-E-E-P, stands for Just Enough Essential Parts. The American half track there, that's a 9-ton armoured vehicle. I bought that for me 40th birthday, you know, so it gives you an idea of the madness of me.
When it comes to buying, people have hobbies. Do you reach a point where it's quite addictive that you know, there's one more thing, and if I could get one of those, you don't know when to stop?
Yeah, well, space is the problem here. So I've kind of got to that point now where I'm actually particularly picking out items to finish off a display.
Is there something you don't have that you'd love to have from the military world?
You ask anybody, and everybody that's collecting military, they'll all say yes, you know. For me, it probably would be a Sherman tank or a T-34 tank, which is a Russian tank.
Maybe for the 50th, William.
Yeah, don't think so. I don't think I have like, you're talking now for a Sherman tank. Now you're talking about £350,000. For a Tiger tank, you're talking about £6 million. You know, so they're out of my budget. They're way out of it. You know, not going to happen. Walking up the stairs, and we'll be back into World War II. Motorbikes. Interesting motorbike there. BSA. Motorbike. BSA stands for Birmingham Small Arms. If you were from Birmingham, BSA, the locals said BSA stood for Best Scrap Available. If you're in the Irish Army or the British Army, BSA, the soldier said bloody sore arse. So that's the BSA motorbike for you. But they also made push bikes, and hanging out the ceiling there, that's actually a folding bike there, and that would have been thrown out of an aeroplane on its own parachute, and when it landed on the ground, you took the parachute off it and then you cycled off into combat.
I see here, William, in the World War II section, there's a big backdrop here, a fantastic old photograph of the D-Day landings at Normandy.
Yes, and if you actually look at the picture there, you'll actually see that. You'll see American half-tracks, you'll see jeeps, Dodge weapons carriers, ambulances, lorries. But another thing that's very interesting here is actually the life belt. This is actually a life belt. And this is probably one of the best inventions until they actually put it into reality. On D-Day, the 6th of June, they were sending in men onto Omaha Beach, Utah Beach, Gold Beach, all these areas. And you had to wear this underneath your armpits. So the best way to wear that was underneath your armpits there. Now, the men, they knew they weren't going to be able to supply them for at least 24 hours when they hit the beach. So they get them extra equipment. So the men were supposed to be carrying 60 pounds of equipment. They were carrying 85 pounds. Now, if you're going to carry 85 pounds of equipment, you're going to put it in your backpack, on your back. Now, this belt no longer fitted you underneath your armpits. So the actual men wore it down around their waist. You're now top heavy. On D-Day 6th of June, approximately 9,980 men were killed on D-Day the 6th of June. A third of them actually drowned, because what was supposed to save your life actually killed you, because when they hit the water, they flipped over and actually drowned. So it just shows
that
you...
It does look incredibly flimsy for a life jacket, particularly if you're carrying all that gear.
Yeah. And that's the reality of it. So they just... It's just things that were supposed to work just didn't work.
There's a bit of a recurring theme of the harsh realities of war instead of maybe just the weapons and the way it all is in the films.
Well, that's the reality of it. Like the best plans, like the first Gulf War, and I said it was the most organised war ever, the first Gulf War. 50% of all casualties, friendly fire. That was Americans shot up the British or their own men by accident. There's always mistakes in war. They call it friendly fire. Nothing friendly about it at all. So then they changed it from friendly to blue on blue, because the blue lines were you and the red lines were the enemy. So they call it blue on blue then, you know. So you just see how things change. But yet, here we are 100 years on from World War One, and some things just never change. We've just got better at killing each other, but they're still making the same mistakes.